everybody. Welcome back to the DC Hospital Association's Continuing Education Initiative for the Improvement in the Treatment of People Who Use Banned and Non-Prescribed Drugs in the District. As always, I'm Laura. I am an ER doctor in the district and in Baltimore. Today, we're going to deviate a little bit from our talk from the past couple of months about buprenorphine and the medical treatment of opioid use disorder, and talk a little bit more about the human-facing side of addiction treatment in the district. Specifically today, we are going to be talking a little bit about the use of peer-provided support and counseling for people who use drugs and alcohol in the district. So before we get too into this, there are a lot of terms that are sort of used throughout the literature to refer to the specialists who provide peer-centered support to people who use drugs and alcohol. All of these terms have a little bit of nuance. They're a little bit different and have a little bit different training. But for the ease of discussion today, I will be using the term peers to sort of refer to all of these clinicians and individuals as a single group. So I thought this was an important topic to do a sort of dedicated episode on, because when I was in medical school, I graduated in 2018, peers weren't really part of the clinical care team just yet, at least where I was. When I did psychiatry, we did have 12-step programs within the hospital as a resource, but we didn't have individual peer counselors or one-on-one peer support services available to people who use drugs or alcohol. So I didn't really get a lot of training in medical school on sort of what the role of a peer was, what their utility was, what the evidence was behind them. And I've sort of had to learn about this a little bit on the job and in my experience with both patients who use drugs and in my sort of clinical work working with peers. So I sort of wanted to do a review of what is the literature and what is the evidence and what is the training and what is the efficacy for peer services, so that we as clinicians can sort of make sure that we are fully valuing, fully respecting, and just sort of incorporating these services as holistically and as sort of encompassingly as possible. I'm very lucky, so I'm going to do a quick intro and review of the literature today, but then I'm also very lucky that I have one of our peers who works with DCHA and works with me clinically at one of our hospitals is here with us to chat with us about what clinicians can better understand about peers in the DC area treatment networks, and then sort of we're going to chat a little bit about how we can work together better and make each other's lives and jobs better. So as with most things in the dish, well, in this field in general, the evidence on sort of peer support services and their efficacy in the treatment of people who use drugs, it's sort of rapidly evolving, and it's a little bit challenging to measure for a variety of reasons, which we'll discuss. But I'll be presenting the literature as it stands, sort of my perspective about how it applies to our clinical practice, and then the recommendations of DC Health, DC Hospital Association, and the patterns that we're sort of using throughout the district. As always, send us a note if you have major concerns about this content or questions. Okay, so just to start philosophically for a minute, the idea of people with lived experience with addiction or substance use, it's not a new one. This has been sort of the framework of treatment for decades, if not, you know, centuries. This is sort of the framework of AA and NA and other sort of talk-based treatment modalities. One of the sources I found suggested that the concept of peer and community support goes back about 300 years. So I'll link that in the show notes if you're interested. But sort of peer services as we utilize them and see them in the hospital are a little bit different from this broader concept of sort of community support. And we'll be talking a little bit more narrowly about sort of the medicalized framework of peer support services. So I mentioned this at the very beginning, but before we get too into this, it is worth just stating again that peers, as I'll be referring to them today, are defined and trained and utilized in a lot of different ways across across the country, across the world. licensing is different. The settings that peers practice in is very different. Their roles and their responsibilities are very, very different and are very contingent on both the individual providing support, the community they're serving, and then what other resources are sort of available in the treatment system that they're working in. So the literature is a little bit inconclusive. The research itself is a little bit hard to do because there is a lot of variation. It's hard to sort of define your terms as a really standard sort of unit to measure a standard outcome on. That said, the literature does overall support the use of peers in a variety of contexts. So I'm going to start by going quickly over the model of peers and substance use recovery that's presented by SAMHSA. They have a really good sort of two-pager flyer thing about peer services that references two major systematic reviews that sort of support the efficacy and the utility of peers. So to quote per SAMHSA, peers provide, quote, lived experience of recovery combined with training and supervision to assist others in initiating and maintaining recovery, end quote, either in support or as an alternative to medical, like clinical treatment. So the lived recovery, lived experience is sort of the point that I think we really need to focus on. Patients come into the healthcare setting and there's already a bit of a power dynamic between patients and clinicians sort of at the best of time. And then patients with active addiction, especially patients in active withdrawal, come in with even more of sort of a power imbalance. And peers sort of bring the focus a little bit back onto the patient and to the patient's lived experience. The way SAMHSA refers to this is peers help build recovery capital, which they define as the internal and external resources to build and maintain recovery. So if we're looking at this in terms of people come into the hospital and they have an experience of medical trauma or they have a negative experience with the healthcare system, it's pretty hard to take our advice. It's pretty hard to take our recommendations as being truly in their best interest, particularly when we are condescending or dismissive. And it's sort of hard to build that internal motivation in the light of maybe not feeling fully appreciated or fully recognized as a person in the medical setting. So peers help to sort of invest, I think, a little bit in patients and help them develop that, again, the recovery capital, the sort of internal motivation and external resources to sort of change their behavior. SAMHSA goes on to define the skills and services provided by peers, which they describe as emotional support, information about community resources, particularly community resources that nurses and doctors might not otherwise know, instrumental social supports like housing and employment, and affiliational support, including connection to recovery networks like AA or SMART, that are available in the community in which the patient lives and the peer works. Peers work directly with patients to help build a sort of individualized, personalized recovery plan, or if the patient's goal is not necessarily sobriety or abstinence, a plan for their overall health and well-being. So the peer's role in the medical setting as individuals with lived experience allows them to sort of build a relationship of trust with patients who are, again, often marginalized and have often experienced medical trauma that has degraded their trust in the healthcare setting. So peers go a really long way of sort of allowing people back into the fold of healthcare and allowing them to have some trust and feel some feeling of safety within the medical community. Peers, so I always sort of preface this with, I have the bias of, I work in the ER, my sort of knowledge is pretty centered around the ER, but peers are used in so many settings, all settings, from recovery centers, from the criminal justice setting, to community outreach work, to hospitals, to clinics, to emergency departments. Clearly the roles are going to be different in each of these settings. Their patient interactions are going to be different in each of these settings, but their overarching goal is sort of similar throughout, which is connecting with and empowering people who use substances or banned drugs to help facilitate their self-actualization and help connect the patient to the things that they need to progress towards their goals, whatever their goals are. So, okay, peers as a overarching theme slash term being defined, with anything in medicine, the powers that be, the funders, and the clinicians that are implementing a change in practice always have to talk about efficacy and cost effectiveness. So again, defining the efficacy of peers is challenging since peers are sort of a ill-defined, I hate saying ill-defined when I just spent 10 minutes defining them, but a little bit of an ill-defined role. And practice in so many roles and so many settings, and there's so many factors to their efficacy that are sort of outside of their control. That said, we're going to talk quickly about their efficacy anyway. So I've said this before on this podcast. We've sort of traditionally, as a medical complex, have sort of defined success in the treatment of people who use drugs as sobriety. And abstinence from whatever substance a patient traditionally uses. I tend to skew away from this as a marker of efficacy. I think that can be a great goal, and for a lot of patients, that the goal is abstinence. But I think a maybe more humanistic and a more realistic goal to measure an effective treatment has to include other things as well. So, for people who use substances, I think we can also consider the reduction in their use, if that's their goal. The reduction in chaotic, dangerous, disorganized, or harmful use, I think, is a good goal for anybody. A reduction in overdoses, either fatal or non-fatal. The reduced utilization of unplanned emergency and hospital-based services that are connected to your substance use. Overall, I think we need to bring this back to sort of any patient success and incorporate patient satisfaction and retention in treatment. With banned substances in particular, we can look at involvement with the criminal justice system and decreasing one's connection to criminal justice as a marker of success. And then just increased connection with medical services, the sort of increased feeling of safety to access services, increased stability of housing, and then increased access to other sort of material drivers of health, like food services, health services, things like that. So not just looking at success in terms of abstinence from a substance, but also sort of whole person wellness and whole person fulfillment and just overall well-being. So, looking at the efficacy of peers in sort of these a little bit more humanistic light, again, while the literature varies and it's effectively impossible to do a case control or a randomized control trial with regards to peer services, also very challenging to extract peers as the single variable that's different between groups. The literature does still broadly suggest that engagement with peer services helps at least to some degree with all of these markers of success. Pretty much no matter how you define success, including if you want to make abstinence from substances one of your markers of success, peer support services are correlated with increased success. There are two pretty major systematic reviews that sort of draw these conclusions, extract these trends. I will link to both of these in the show note. And then, as I mentioned, SAMHSA has a infographic one pager that sort of extracts all of these points as well. They also have a link to these two reviews, and I think they actually do a really nice job of sort of pulling out the high yield points. So I can't give you an exact number of how many overdoses will appear in your setting, reduce, or, to what percentage will they increase patient satisfaction? I can't give you those numbers, but as an overall trend, the literature does support that peers improve a patient who uses banned drugs or other substances. They do overall increase their well-being across these different markers of success. They tend to help reduce relapses. They tend to help reduce overall substance use. Peers help facilitate access to social support systems. And this is a little bit of a self-serving interest, they help reduce utilization of emergency services as well as rehospitalizations. If you are like me and work in an ER in the district, you know, sort of I think an ER probably anywhere in the world right now, we're run pretty thin. So reducing unnecessary, or not unnecessary, but reducing preventable visits to the ER by sort of providing these services is always a great thing for me. Peers are associated with increased retention in substance use treatment, and they improve relationships overall with treatment providers, which sort of increases your motivation to engage and participate and complete or continue in treatment. And then I just want to bring this one up again. Peers are connected with increased patient satisfaction with their own treatment. So this is one of those things. I'm going to speak briefly in a second about the sort of financial benefit to hospitals of hiring and retaining peers. But I think the patient satisfaction is probably the thing that sort of gets buried in all of this a little bit of, you know, we like to talk about, but does it work in terms of, does it prevent deaths? Does it prevent drug use? Does it prevent whatever? Does it save us money? But I do want to just highlight that, the patient experience is something that particularly with people who use banned or otherwise stigmatized substances, the sort of patient experience and the reduction of patient trauma is a huge thing that we don't necessarily incorporate and don't even really measure a lot of the time. So I do think that that's probably the most conclusive, I don't think it's the most conclusive evidence. That's the most sort of intuitive appeal of peers for me. I think it's my stance on this is even if I didn't have this literature that suggests these other markers of success, the fact that peers provide an improved patient experience for a group of people that is traditionally very marginalized, that's enough for me. It's probably not going to be enough for people that fund these programs, but it is something sort of worth considering. From a financial perspective, again, it's very, very hard to put a dollar amount on any one individual peer's services. But there is it's actually a master's thesis, I believe, out of Hopkins a couple years ago that looked at peer service programs' impact on hospital costs. And their findings suggested that peers or a peer program can save a hospital over $1 million. In opioid-related expenses by preventing repeat visits for infections, for injuries, for overdoses, over just the course of a year. So those cost savings magnify, obviously, over a longer period of time, reducing complications of drug use, including especially infection or injection drug use, including infection, injuries, endocarditis, osteomyelitis, all of the things we sort of commonly associate with particularly IV drugs. So even over a relatively short period of time, peer services can save a ton of money to the hospital, certainly more than their salaries generally are, and over a longer period of time, have sort of increased implications for cost savings to both the hospital and the broader healthcare system, by reducing patient connection with the criminal justice system. They have obviously, further societal cost savings. Incarceration is extremely expensive. And reducing connection to the criminal justice system and reducing criminalization of people who use substances has, outside of even just the direct health savings, has huge cost savings for sort of society a little bit more broadly. So again, I can't, you know, this is a hard sort of conversation to have with doctors, particularly because I can tell you how much a dose of buprenorphine costs. I can tell you how much a, well, in general, how much a hospitalization for endocarditis costs, but peer services are a little bit more nebulous, and it's very, very challenging to say exactly how much of a rehospitalization or an overdose or a relapse versus a period of prolonged sobriety or a period of less chaotic drug use can be attributed directly to a peer. So it's much harder to sort of do that direct cost saving analysis. But even with sort of these limitations and the challenges of defining exactly what a peer is and what services a peer provides, the cost savings are pretty significant.